Well, the scriptures are preparing us to move on from Abraham as the focus, to Isaac, then to Jacob, then to the 12 sons of Jacob, who are the Israelites. Now, just as Abraham needed descendants for the covenants of promise to be carried on, then so would Isaac. And the first step towards that end was a suitable wife. Abraham knew that the choice of a wife for Isaac was all important. So he used his highest, best, most trustworthy servant to go find Isaac a wife, but in a manner carefully prescribed by Abraham. Now, the first matter is that the choice must not be a Canaanite woman. Okay, after all, if Abraham and his descendants were to possess the land, it would not be well for Isaac to enter into an allegiance, a marriage, with one whose family was soon going to be dispossessed of their land. Besides, Abraham didn't want a woman raised in the Canaanite religions to raise the children of the covenant promise. And second, in the unlikely event that the servant was unsuccessful in persuading the chosen wife to come to Canaan, the servant was not to take Isaac up to Mesopotamia for the marriage ceremony. So, the servant, Abraham's servant, is set north, back up into Abraham's homeland, Mesopotamia. And further, he is to find a family member for Isaac to marry. Now, we can understand why back in chapter 22, we were given Abraham's brother's genealogy, because Abraham was hopeful it would be from among those family members that Isaac's future bride would come. Now, Abraham wasn't worried because he knew God was preparing the way for this. The worried party was the servant, not Abraham. That said, the fact that Abraham made the servant recite an oath, plus the fact that Abraham was now very old and fully realizing that his last breath could come at any moment, this says that Abraham suspected he might not live to see the day that his son Isaac obtained a wife. Therefore, since he might not be around to examine and give blessing to the proposed wife, he gave all the requirements and disqualifications for a wife for Isaac to his servant to now go carry it out in his stead. Now, this oath is recited with Abraham requiring the servant to put his hand under Abraham's thigh. Now, that some kind of gesture accompanied an oath was normal for that and really for all eras, including our modern age. Even in Abraham's time, we have records of a hand being raised as part of a swearing to a promise. But what does a hand under a thigh mean? The word thigh, as translated into English, thigh, is a Hebrew idiom, and it refers to the male genitals. Now, as weird and just plain icky as that might sound, there is a meaning to this that the ancient sages have spoken of that makes a lot of sense. Now, whether they're right about it or not, I can't say for sure. It is in the male genitals that the sign of the covenant with Jehovah is carried out, circumcision. Genesis 17:11, "And you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin. It shall be the sign of the covenant between me and you." Later on in Genesis, we will find Jacob, who's Abraham, will be Abraham's grandson, requiring the same thing of this hand under the thigh gesture of swearing an oath from Joseph. So, this odd custom is seen as invoking the power and the presence of God as the one who created the covenant and also the one who guarantees this oath. Now, we find this exact gesture nowhere else in any culture at any time. And the only two mentions of it in the Bible are the ones I just gave to you, and they involve patriarchs and the carrying out of the provisions of the covenant. The words of instruction that Abraham gives to a servant are the last recorded words of Abraham in the Bible. And the transition we see between some of his first recorded statements versus what we now read is striking. Here, his faith is firm. There's no worry in Abraham, because for him, it's all in God's hands. He completely trusts that Jehovah will bring about everything that he had promised to Abraham. Oh, to have a faith like that. Before he asked, how will I know I'll possess the land? And he lied about Sarah being his wife. And he wanted to know how he'd have many descendants if Sarah was barren, and so on. See, this is what years and years of walking with God brings. It brings a maturity in faith. It just doesn't happen fast enough, does it? Now, this trusted servant, probably still Eliezer of Damascus, spoken of in earlier chapters, has been much affected by Abraham because he journeys back to Mesopotamia, Abraham's birthplace, and as he arrives in the city of Nahor, he prays to God that God's will would be done. Now, notice, and although in some Bible versions, Eliezer is shown calling God Adonai or Lord, in the original Hebrew, he calls God Jehovah. He uses God's personal name. Open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 24. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 22. Kind of a long chapter. We're going to read it all in one setting. So we get all the context of it. By now, Avram was very old, advanced in years, and Adonai had blessed Avram in everything. Avram said to the servant who had served him the longest, who was in charge of all he owned, put your hand under my thigh because I want you to swear by Adonai, God of heaven and God of earth, that you will not choose a wife for my son from among the women of the Canaanites among whom I'm living, but that you will go to my homeland, to my kinsmen, to choose a wife for my son, Isaac. And the servant replied, suppose the woman isn't willing to follow me to this land. Must I then bring your son to the land from which you came? Abraham said to him, see to it you don't bring my son back there. Adonai, the God of heaven, who took me away from my father's house and away from the land I was born in, and who spoke to me and swore to me, I'll give this land to your descendants, he will send his angel ahead of you, and you are to bring a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is unwilling to follow you, then you are released from your obligation under my oath. Just don't bring my son back there. The servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning the matter. Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels, all kinds of gifts from his master. He got up and went to Aram Naharaim, to Nahor's city. Toward evening, when the women go out to draw water, he had the camels kneel down outside the city by the well. And he said, Adonai, God of my master Abraham, please let me succeed today and show your grace to my master Abraham. Here I am, standing by the spring as the daughters of the townsfolk come out to draw water. I will say to one of the girls, please lower your jug so that I can drink. And if she answers, yes, drink, and I'll water your camels as well, then let her be the one you intend for your servant, Isaac. Now this is how I will know that you have shown grace to my master. Before he had finished speaking, Rivkah, the daughter of Betuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, came out with her jug on her shoulder. The girl was very beautiful, a virgin, never having had sexual relations with any man. She went down to the spring, filled her jug, and came up. And the servant ran to meet her and said, please, give me a sip of water from your jug to drink. Drink, my lord, she replied, and immediately lowered her jug onto her arm and let him drink. And when she was through letting him drink, she said, I will also draw water for your camels until they have drunk their fill. She quickly emptied her jug into the trough, then ran to the well to draw water, kept drawing water for all of his camels. The man gazed at her in silence, waiting to find out whether Adonai had made his trip successful or not. When the camels were done drinking, the man took a gold nose ring, weighing 1/5 of an ounce, and 2 gold bracelets weighing 4 ounces and asked, "Whose daughter are you? Tell me, please. Is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night?" She answered, "I'm the daughter of Betuel, the son Milcah bore to Nahor," adding, "We have plenty of straw and fodder and room for staying overnight." The man bowed his head and prostrated himself before Adonai. And then he said, "Blessed be Adonai, God of my master Avraham, who has not abandoned his faithful love for my master, because Adonai has guided me to the house of my master's kinsman." The girl ran off, told her mother's household what had happened. Rivkah had a brother named Laban. And when he saw the nose ring and the bracelets on his sister's wrists beside, and when he heard his sister Rivkah report of what the man had said to her, he ran out to the spring and found the man standing there by the camels. "Come on in," he said, "you whom Adonai has blessed. Why are you standing outside when I've made a room in the house and prepared a place for the camels?" So the man went inside, and while the camels were being unloaded and provided straw and fodder, water was brought for him to wash his feet and the feet of the men with him. But when a meal was set before him, he said, "I won't eat until I say what I have to say," Laban said. "Speak," he said, "I am Avraham's servant. Adonai has greatly blessed my master so that he's grown wealthy. He has given him flocks and herds, silver and gold, male and female slaves, camels and donkeys. Sarah, my master's wife, bore my master a son when she was old, and he has given him everything he has. My master made me swear, saying, 'You are not to choose a wife for my son from among the women of the Canaanites among whom I am living. Rather, you are to go to my father's house, to my kinsmen, to choose a wife for my son.' I said to my master, 'Suppose the woman isn't willing to follow me?' Avraham answered me, 'Adonai, in whose presence I live, will send his angel with you to make your trip successful. You are to pick a wife for my son from my kinsmen in my father's house. This will release you from your obligation under my oath. But if when you come to my kinsmen, they refuse to give her to you, this too will release you from my oath.' So today, I came to the spring and I said, 'Adonai, God of my master Avraham, if you are causing my trip to succeed in its purpose, then here I am, standing by the spring. I will say to one of the girls coming out to draw water, "Let me have a sip of water from your jug." And if she answers, 'Yes, drink, I'll water your camels as well,' then let her be the woman you intend for my master's son." And even before I had finished speaking to my heart, there came Rivkah, going out with her jug on her shoulder. She went down to the spring and drew water. And when I said to her, "Please let me have a drink," she immediately lowered the jug from her shoulder and said, "Drink, I will water your camels as well." So I drank, and she had the camels drink too. And I asked, "Whose daughter are you?" And she answered, "The daughter of Betuel, the son of Nahor, whom Milcah bore to him." Then I put the ring on her nose and the bracelets on her wrists. I bowed my head and prostrated myself before Adonai and blessed Adonai, God of my master Avraham, for having led me in the right way to obtain my master's brother's granddaughter for his son. So now, if you people intend to show grace and truth to my master, tell me. But if not, tell me, so that I can turn elsewhere." Laban and Betuel replied, "Since this comes from Adonai, we can't say anything to you, either good or bad. Rivkah is here in front of you. Take her. Go. Let her be your master's son's wife, as Adonai has said." When Avraham's servant heard what they said, he prostrated himself on the ground to Adonai. And then the servant brought out silver and gold jewelry, together with clothing, gave them to Rivkah. He also gave valuable gifts to her brother and mother. He and his men then ate and drank and stayed the night. In the morning they got up, and he said, "Send me off to my master." Her brother and mother said, "Let the girl stay with us a few days, at least 10. After that she'll go." And he answered, "Don't delay me, since Adonai has made my trip successful, but let me go back to my master." They said, "We will call the girl and see what she says." They called Rivkah, asked her, "Will you go with this man?" She replied, "I will." So they sent their sister Rivkah away with her nurse, Avraham's servant, and his men. They blessed Rivkah with these words, our sister. May you be the mother of millions. May your descendants possess the cities of those who hate them. Then Rivka and her maids mounted the camels and followed the man. So the servant took Rivka and went on his way. Now meanwhile, Yitzhak, one evening after coming along the road from Beer Lachai Roi, he was living in the Negev, went out walking in a field. And as he looked up, he saw camels approaching. Rivka, too, looked up. And when she saw Yitzhak, she quickly dismounted the camel. She said to the servant, "Who is this man walking in the field to meet us?" And when the servant replied, "It's my master," she took her veil and covered herself. The servant told Isaac everything he had done. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent and took Rivka, and she became his wife, and he loved her. This was Yitzhak comforted for the loss of his mother. Now here we're going to see something we'll often encounter in the Bible. A woman or women coming to the well to fetch water. This is not a romantic notion. This is not some literary device. Women of the Middle East in that day stayed separate from the men for the most part. There were certain times of the day when it was understood that women would go to the water well or to a spring or to a river to draw water. This was a standard task for women, and usually men would not be around. Now, this was all about traditional Middle Eastern modesty. And in particular, this applied to unmarried girls and young married women. Therefore, often when we get a narrative about a male Bible character encountering a woman at the well or the spring, there is this sense of surprise. The girl is startled at the sight of her, or the voice of a man. And this practice is still prevalent in many parts of the world today. The interesting part of this chapter occurs in verse 10 because it speaks of Abraham's servant taking 10 camels with him for his trek to the north to go wife hunting. Now, most archaeologists will say this is not possible because camels were unknown to the region at that time, this time being around 1850 to 1900 BC. Some fairly recent findings, though, shed a little light on this matter. Records found in southern Mesopotamia from the old Babylonian kingdom era, that's from around 2000 BC, make mention of drinking camel's milk. Further, some Sumerian and Akkadian writings from the same era make mention of a creature used for transportation that literally is called a donkey of the sea land. And with those writings were pictographs of dromedaries, what we erroneously call one-hump camels. In fact, a dromedary is not a camel. A dromedary is a one-humped creature. A camel is a two-humped creature. It seems as though the original habitat of the camel was Mesopotamia and the Far East, while the original habitat of the dromedary was the Arabian Peninsula far to the south. That Abraham might have dromedaries makes all kinds of sense, as he roamed the southern regions and constantly dealt with Semite tribes of the south. So this idea that Genesis 24 is a much later addition or redaction just doesn't hold any water. Understand, Eliezer went to the well at the time of the day he did because he knew that's when he'd find some eligible females. This wasn't a type of fortuitous coincidence. In the Middle East, if you wanted to find a young girl, this is the place, the well. He sees some girls coming, and he proceeds to lay out a kind of a fleece before God. That is, he sets up a kind of a test so that he can be sure that the woman he picks for Isaac is the woman God intends. And wouldn't you know it, before he's even finished speaking to God, the answer to his prayers arrives in the form of Rivka, Rebecca, daughter of Betuel. Betuel is Abraham's nephew. He is the son of Abraham's brother, Nahor. So, Bethuel, Rivka's father, would have been Isaac's first cousin. Rivka is a daughter of Isaac's first cousin, was his second cousin. So the relationship between Isaac and Rivka would be by blood, but not too close, second cousins. Because Rivka spoke the exact words that Eliezer had set out as a fleece, he knew he was on the right track. But he kept silent because he wanted to see how this was going to play out. He wanted to be sure that she kept drawing water until all 10 camels Eliezer brought with him were fully satisfied. Satisfied was probably pretty impressive to Eliezer. That's a lot of water, folks. So he then takes the next step. Eliezer gives the girl, Rebecca, Rivka, gifts of significant value, including, yes, a nose ring. Not at all an unusual piece of jewelry for that day. Of course, Rebecca races home, tells her mother and the other female clan members what just happened. And when Rebecca's brother, Laban, who will play an important role in the biblical story sometime in the future, sees this expensive jewelry being worn by his sister, he runs to meet this man who gave her all these things. Now, while meeting a stranger, a guest, is always a big deal back in that day, the fact that this is a wealthy stranger, that's what excites Laban. Laying on the schmooze, Laban even invokes the name of Yehovah in greeting Eliezer. Now, we shouldn't be too impressed or draw very much from this. Later, we're going to find out that Laban possessed many gods. So he was just being cordial and using the name of the god that Eliezer's master worshipped. Now, Eliezer is invited to stay with the family, but to begin by having a meal. First things first. Eliezer is a loyal servant, and he's on a mission. So he wants to know if he's just wasting his time. He states straight away for the record who his master is, what his goal is. Then there can be no doubt that the girl's modesty was not violated, nor that she had committed anything untoward in speaking with a male. All intentions are honorable. So he restates everything that was told to him, how he carried out his duties, how it all led him to Rivka. In customary Eastern hospitality, Rebecca's father and brother say that it is far from them to go against God's will for their daughter, especially with that rich guy. Now, little doubt, it was not that they were so anxious to get rid of Rebecca. They knew from those expensive bracelets, that nose ring, that the customary gifts they would receive in exchange for the giving of her hand would be, in this case, be a king's ransom. And it was. After a little more bartering, Rebecca, along with the women who cared for her as a child, accompanied Eliezer back to Canaan. Now notice, interestingly, how little the father, Bethuel, plays in all this. Laban, Rivka's brother, is the dominant player from Rivka's side of the family. This is unusual. The only explanation would be that Bethuel was feeble from age or sickness, and as would have been customary, Laban, probably Bethuel's firstborn, had taken over the duties as guardian of the clan's unmarried females. So in verses 54 through 55, when we see Eliezer asking for leave to take Rivka and go, it is her mother and brother, not her father, who request that she not go just yet. A little more dickering. And upon Rivka stating she was ready to go, permission to leave is granted. And the scriptures tell us that Rivka's nurse accompanies her on the journey. Now, apparently this so-called nurse is a much loved family member that could have, that well have actually been the infant and toddler Rivka's wet nurse, who eventually became sort of a companion and guardian for Rivka. In fact, the Hebrew word translated nurse here is meneket, meneket, which means wet nurse. Now, of course, Rivka was well beyond that stage of life, so it likely indicates that this personal nurse began her stay with the family as Rivka's wet nurse and then continued on from there. Now, as Rivka and her nurse and several handmaidens mount the camels, get ready to leave for Canaan, a benediction is pronounced over Rivka. And to my surprise, this was not a standard pronouncement given in that era over a young girl traveling to enter into marriage. Not at all. Rather, this is a divine prophecy that I'm sure her family had no idea they were even speaking. And it concerns her producing a large number of descendants and that these descendants would have victory over their enemies. This, of course, plays in perfectly with the covenant that God has made with Abraham, the covenant which now would be inherited by Rivka's future husband, Isaac. So the caravan now arrives back from its journey. Isaac and Rebekah lay eyes on each other for the first time. The covering of her face with a veil is kind of interesting. I've heard many teachings on this part of Genesis. And it was always taught that women in that era covered their faces with veils in the presence of males. Well, it turns out that's simply not the case. Hebrew women, in particular, didn't wear veils. There is no mention of Sarah, for instance, ever wearing a veil. And it was not a Mesopotamian custom to wear veils as a show of modesty. Now, there was some use of veils in that part of the world in that era as a kind of decoration, even as a show of wealth. The only customary use of a veil among Israelites, Canaanites, Mesopotamians, Sumerians, and so on, had to do with wedding and betrothal procedures. It was customary for the bride to be married with her veil down, and the groom not allowed to see her without that veil for some amount of time before the wedding ceremony. A little history of where the modern practice of the bridal veil comes from. So what this likely indicated was that Rivka was letting Isaac know that she was the one his father had chosen for him, and also that she had consented to be his wife, and in fact the betrothal period had already been entered into. Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah. The father and mother for the next generation of the line of promise was now in place. What's kind of interesting is that we're told that Isaac and Rebekah went into the tent of Isaac's deceased mother, and apparently that tent became theirs. Now remember, in this era, men and women generally stayed separate even after marriage. Husbands and wives, particularly if they were wealthy or the heads of large clans, slept in separate quarters. Actually, what happened here is that the bride and the groom entering into Sarah's tent was a what was symbolic of Rivka assuming the position of matriarch that Sarah had held until her death. Sarah's tent had been maintained just for this ceremonial purpose until a bride for Isaac had been found. I very much like how the chapter ends when the scripture states that Isaac found great comfort, finally, in the loss of his mother by marrying Rivka. Obviously, up until Rivka, Sarah had been Isaac's primary contact with the female world. He must have been quite close with his mother. Let's read a little bit of Genesis chapter 25 at this point. Open up your Bibles to Genesis chapter 25. Page 25. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, we're just going to read the first 11 verses. Abraham took another wife, whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimran, Yokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shuach. Yokshan fathered Shiva and Dedan. The sons of Dedan were Ashrim, Latushim, and Lumim. The sons of Midian were Ephah, Epher, Hanok, Avidah, and Eldadah. All these were descendants of Keturah. Abraham gave everything he owned to Yitzhak, but to the sons of the concubines he made grants while he was still living and sent them off to the east to the land of Kedem, away from Isaac, his son. This is how long Abraham lived, 175 years. Then Abraham breathed his last, dying at a ripe old age, an old man full of years. He was gathered to his people. Yitzhak and Ishmael, his sons, buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, by Mamre, the field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Het. Abraham was buried there with Sarah, his wife. After Abraham died, God blessed Isaac, his son, and Isaac lived near Beer Lachai Roi. Man, there's a lot of information jam-packed into this chapter, and I suspect that prior to the year 1948 and the absolutely unthinkable fulfillment of the prophecy that Israel would be reborn as a nation of Jews, this listing of tribes coming from Abraham would have been relatively unimportant, except maybe for librarians and historians. But now that Israel has returned to their homeland, and with the happenings of the Middle East that are shaking the whole earth like never before, these genealogical listings take on a little more important tone for the church, especially, as does the strange circumstances of the birth of Isaac's twin sons, Jacob and Esau. This is the winding up of the story of Abraham, and then in later verses, Ishmael. And we are given some information about Abraham that we simply need to make some mental notation about. First of all, Abraham took another wife, a woman named Keturah, of whom we know next to nothing. Bible scholars aren't even totally clear whether or not Abraham was married to Sarah at the same time he was married to Keturah. That said, after some further study and researching, I think it's clear. We should not assume that Abraham's taking Keturah as a wife was in chronological sequence with the previous chapter of Genesis. That is, that Keturah necessarily came after Sarah. This literary device the Torah employs by interrupting the sequence of events, going back a few years, adding some new information about someone or something, is not unusual for either the Bible as a whole or other writings from other cultures in that era, even eras well before and well after that. One possibility concerning the timing of Keturah stands out above all the rest, at least to me. These sons of Abraham that are born through Keturah could have been born to Abraham before Isaac. This is because Abraham was far past human ability for a male to sire a child, as it was for Sarah to produce a child when Isaac was conceived. Therefore, unless these sons from Keturah were miraculous conceptions, they had to have come well before Sarah bore the miracle baby, Isaac. Of course, one could argue that upon God making Abraham capable of siring Isaac, Abraham regained his fertility for an extended period of time. That's possible. And several scholars choose that approach. Anyway, I just want you to see that it's pretty much impossible to nail it down exactly when Abraham took Keturah as a wife and when these other children were born and whether these sons came before or after Isaac. Now, we're told that Keturah gave Abraham several children, of which six of them are mentioned. We have no idea who Keturah is. We don't know who her ancestors were. And as is customary in the Bible, only the male children are mentioned, but it's unthinkable that Keturah didn't also give Abraham several daughters as well. However, it is clear that the etymology of Keturah's name is the Hebrew word ketoret, ketoret, which means spices. And in fact, certain tribes that have long been suspected as being descendants of Abraham and Keturah were associated with the spice trade in ancient times. It's also helpful for us to know that the prime spice-producing region for the Middle East at that time, for many centuries to come, really, was an area of southern Arabia that today we call Yemen. This also shows just how extensive and regular trade and travel was among these ancient peoples even very long ago. Now, we're going to run into several of these named children of Keturah later on in Scripture, and yet others we'll never hear of again. So I want to point out one son in particular, because the territory he settled in was going to play a large role in Moses' life. That son's name is Midian. And true to his mother's name, the Midianites were spice traders, particularly of the highly valued spice frankincense. Their territory was located on the Arabian Peninsula, bordered by the eastern edge of the finger of the Red Sea, today called the Gulf of Aqaba. These are the same Midianites, the same region where Moses fled from Egypt, where God came to Moses in a burning bush, where Moses found a wife. In fact, it's my view that the Gulf of Aqaba is the biblical Red Sea that Moses led the Israelites through to safety when they were fleeing from the armies of Pharaoh. These six sons of Keturah, along with the son of Hagar, that Egyptian girl, and Ishmael, would go on to form what we loosely call the Arab peoples, people that populated the Middle East and even northern Africa. But I want you to be aware of the term, that the term Arab wasn't even valid until sometime after the reign of King David. That is, there was no such identifiable and named people group as Arabs or Arabians until at least 900 BC, some 9 centuries after the time we're studying. Now, we're told in verse 5, chapter 25, that Abraham gave all of his wealth and his possessions to Isaac, which would have made Isaac a wealthy, powerful man. But it also most certainly set the stage for enormous jealousy and strife between Isaac and his large cadre of half-brothers and sisters, especially Ishmael. And this strife and jealousy continues to this very day, with all those brothers and sisters, dozens at the least. Abraham was going to have to do something to assure that his son Isaac was decisively and without opposition elevated above the rest and given a clear path to continue along the road of covenant promise that Jehovah had ordained. And so, yet again, we have a dramatic example of this ongoing God principle of dividing, electing, and separating. And this time, the object of the division and separation is Isaac. After we are told in verse 5 that Abraham gave everything to Isaac, we're told that Abraham gave gifts before he died to the sons of his concubines. Now, don't get confused here. Although most Bibles say Abraham took Keturah as a wife, and sometime earlier, Hagar as well, these were not technically actual wives, as was Sarah. They were concubines, kind of a different class of wife in those days. These so-called wives would not have been given a ketubah, a marriage contract. They would not have been, there would not have been any kind of a marriage ceremony. Rather, there would have been a simple declaration by Abraham of their status of being included into his household and as legitimate mothers of his children. These concubines were well treated, they were respected, they enjoyed the status of being joined to Abraham's clan, but they did not have the exalted place as a true legal wife. And their children usually would have had somewhat lesser rights of inheritance than the sons of the true legal wife. In fact, the law of that era was, it was entirely up to the father to choose which, if any, of his children that came from concubines would get an inheritance. So while Isaac got all the inheritance and the family authority, the other sons of Abraham, by means of his concubines, got gifts, likely fairly substantial gifts, because Abraham was so wealthy. Now, were there other concubines for Abraham other than Keturah and Hagar? That's possible, but at this point it's unclear. Abraham then sends these sons of his concubines away to other territories. Dividing and electing always leads to separating. Notice the parallel with God permitting circumstances to unfold that led to the necessary separation of Abraham from his nephew Lot. Also notice what direction these sons of concubines were sent. What way were they sent? East. Why east? Why didn't Abraham send them to the north? To the south? Why not to the west? Just keep making little mental notes each time we encounter the direction east. Well, in verse 7, Abraham dies at the ripe old age of 175 years. What a life that man lived. Oh, I mean that each of us could have such a close and intertwined life with the Lord, and that his purpose would be played out through us like it was with Abraham. We are told that he was gathered to his people. This is a term far different from dying or being buried in the ground or going down into Sheol. Rather, it implies a sort of reunion with those who were considered righteous, likely from the line of Seth, Noah, and then Shem, who had come before him. It also speaks to a belief that death is not the end, a concept that will from here forward be built upon only slightly in the Old Testament scriptures, but it'll take on greater meaning with the advent of Christ in the New Testament. That said, I want to repeat something that I want you to watch for as we study Torah. While there is a hint of something beyond death in the statement gathered to his people, there is no mention of going to heaven when we die. I've done a fairly thorough study of death and dying in the Old Testament, and I can tell you with confidence that what lay beyond the grave and afterlife, if you would, is not discussed with any depth at all in the Old Testament. And it seems from the varying terms for death and dying, all the terms being very vague, very general, that it was fuzzy in the minds of the people of the Old Testament what an afterlife, if any, amounted to. For some Hebrews, it's obvious from Scripture that their great fear of dying without a son to carry on the family name spelled the end of their own essence as well. That is, in some unexplained way, a father would live on through his son, not reincarnation, maybe not even with any consciousness of it at all. And the idea of the human spirit being this vessel of existence after death is also not well defined in the Old Testament. The thought that somehow a human would live in heaven with God simply didn't exist until at least the close of the Old Testament, around 400 BC. We are then informed that Ishmael and Isaac came together to bury their father. And as would have been customary when possible, the husband was buried with his wife. Abraham was therefore buried in the same tomb as Sarah, the cave of Machpelah in Hebron, and later Isaac and Rebekah would join them in that same location, as eventually would Jacob. Well, in verse 11, God makes it clear to any who might doubt where the line of promise led when it says, God blessed Isaac, Yitzhak. The handing of the torch from Abraham to his son Isaac is now complete. Isaac is the new patriarch of the Hebrews. Abraham is now just a memory. And we'll continue with Genesis when we meet again.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.